thank you very much for coming. And when people introduce me, I always feel awkward because it's like, how many times have I been wrong in life, right? Like, I was born a Muslim, then I became an atheist, then I was baptized, and it's like, okay. But I got here, and it seems like this is the last stop. I seem to be not going anywhere. Currently, which, you know, I will explain how I got here first, but I live with my husband not about 30 minutes from here in Pennsylvania, and we have 4 kids, ages 9 to 3. This is actually a quiet night for me with all the college kids, if you can imagine the craziness in my house. So the Lord has been good to me, but of course my journey started completely differently. So I was born in this city, near a city called Iconium. It's in the book of Acts, if you're Bible readers. St. Paul was kicked out of this town. And if he visited this town again today, I think his fate would be the same. Not much changed in the last 2,000 years. And my parents were Muslims, but I don't know if you know anything about Turkish history, but Turkey is one of the more liberal, secular Muslim countries. Because at the end of the First World War, the Ottoman Empire collapsed and the Turkish Republic was the last nation state that broke away from the Ottoman Empire. And the founder of the modern Turkey, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, thought that the Ottoman Empire fell from such power. If you read your Catholic history, you will know that all the bad guys were Ottomans. And I still persistently say Istanbul, despite my many friends' disapproval. But so what happened is he thought, the founder of modern Turkey, if we modernize and westernize Turkey, we will not have the same fate. So he literally forcefully changed people's attire. So you weren't allowed to wear the hijab anymore. So you had to get dressed like the Western women. We used to, Turkish is a language on its own, but we used the Arabic script. And he said, no, we're going to use the Latin alphabet. So he made all these changes to make Turkey look more Western on the outside. But obviously, you can change people's hearts. And he also knew and understood that religion has is a social glue that holds the society together. So he said, okay, we're going to stay Muslim, but not too Muslim, but we are not going to be anything else either. So it's a very kind of constructed national identity that we have in Turkey. So what happens is we're kind of stuck between East and the West. So as a Muslim kid, I went to school. I wore my uniform, and we learned about secularism and women's rights and all those like Western ideas in the winter when I went to school. And in the summer, I put my headscarf on, wore long skirts, covered myself up, and went to the local mosque to learn how to read the Quran. So it's kind of like that way, the society in itself is still very Muslim. While if you go to any Turkish city now, you would feel like, hey, this looks kind of, Mediterranean / European. So one of the things that never changed is the social hierarchy that Islam imposes on people. So it's very hard to explain this to Westerners, so bear with me. The God of Islam, which I call Allah, and it just means the God in Arabic, but for the purposes of this, I say Allah. Allah is the master and the Muslim is the slave, right? So there can be no proper relationship. Allah doesn't require, need, or ask for our love. Just our obedience as a Muslim. So this kind of is a master-slave relationship, right? And then what happens is the entire society kind of is constructed around this idea of master-slave. So the man is above women and so on and so forth. So it's like, so it's a very strictly hierarchical culture where women are oppressed, basically. So this is how it reflected on my family. They were both nominal Muslims. My father never really liked fasting, or he never really practiced or anything. But he was Muslim, an Irishman is Catholic. He may never go to mass, he may not have seen a priest for 50 years, but he's Catholic. So it's just the same idea of like, hey, everybody's Muslim. And my father, my mother was a little more pious, not much more, but she didn't cover herself. She was a nurse, but she was also a woman. So while my they would both come home from work, and she had to still cook three different courses of meal every day different, and then wash all our clothes by hand. And then on Sunday, we would have to go to my grandparents' house, and she would have to take care of all the... So she had to be the Western woman who could do it all. But at the same time, that Eastern side was still there, that she had to do all the housework without any input from her husband, because, hey, men don't go into the kitchen in Muslim countries. You know, there's just the woman's realm and the man's realm. I'm not saying this because, like, I am this, like, this feminist, but it's like, look, you know, in some parts of the world, women are actually oppressed. And this is one of the, like, the subtle ways to do it. So that was my idea, you know, that was my life. That was how life is. I didn't know anything different. I didn't think about, like, I didn't think that it could be different. You know, with children, as a child, you kind of, your whole world revolves around your family, basically. And everything was going well. I learned how to read the Quran, and I could recite it. I don't speak Arabic, but I could recite it because Arabic is the only way you can please Allah. Like, if you recite the Quran in Arabic, it's different than like reading it in Turkish. And when I was 11, my parents had went through a really bad divorce, because another thing about Islam is that men can marry multiple wives. So this is forbidden in Turkish law, because we borrowed all these crazy ideas of like monogamy. So what happened is, like, legally you can take one wife, but a lot of men had like mistresses, or like if they had wives, they would just have the religious, you know, religious ceremony on the side. So my father always cheated on my mother, and it was okay because men can't really control their sexual urges. Sorry, father, I had to break this to you after all you went through. So what happens is, like, as long as they keep it on the side, it's okay. So that's what how it was. Like, he always cheated on my mother, but because he was kind of hush-hush about it, she didn't care. But by around when I was 11 or so, he decided that, hey, I'm just going to marry this one, because, you know, I don't know. He was, like, getting bold or something. I don't know, but my mother wouldn't have any of it. So they had a divorce, and it was kind of bad. They had a big fight, and there was like punches. It was just a big mess. And the night of that big fight they had, I was so worried that like my father was going to leave. And he said, I will never leave you for any woman. And the following morning he left, and he never came back. And my mother went into a huge depression. It was just messy. And like, everything under my feet shook. Like, divorce, I don't know if any of you are children of divorce, but it doesn't matter. Like, because we think the world revolves around us. When that world crumbles, it's our fault somehow, right? Like, we just can't, is in our child's mind, it doesn't make sense. And it happens in the West. This didn't happen because my parents were Muslim. And I started to question everything they have ever taught me, right? If they didn't love me enough to stay together, like, why would I ever believe anything they taught me? And that was the very first time I had ever questioned Islam. Again, one of the things with that master-slave relationship is what St. Thomas calls the servile fear. So there are different kinds of fear, right? So there's servile fear and there's filial fear. Servile fear isn't bad in itself, as long as it leads to filial fear. Like, I have a 3-year-old who does not want to listen to me. And I was like, don't touch the stove. Don't touch the stove. Please don't touch the stove. You're going to burn. And next time she tries to touch again, I do this. And she has her fear towards me is servile fear, because she's like, hey, she's much bigger than me. So, like, there is that, you know, that comes from that master-slave relationship. But as she grows up, I'm hoping that she will learn to love me and just not doubt my love ever, to know that, yes, I fear disappointing my mother. Not because she's going to hurt me, right? She's not going to slap, I'm not going to slap her hand when she's 20. But I fear disappointment. So it's like, you know, in the act of contrition, yes, we fear the punishment of hell, but because we are contrite, the perfect contrition is that we have disappointed the God who loves us. So do you see the differences between? So you can start with servile fear, but if it stays in the servile fear, that's imperfect. It needs to grow into filial fear. And in Islam, it's unthinkable that it could ever into a filial fear, because in itself, filial means the love between father and son, a parent and a child, which is unthinkable. So what servile fear does is that it kind of, you grow up with it. It so gets ingrained in you so much that it's almost like spiritually paralyzing. Like there's this like wall around every single Muslim you meet. It can be a secular Muslim, very pious Muslim. There's this wall of fear around them that they have grown up with, the servile fear. And it almost takes like a tragedy, like to kind of put a crack in that wall. And then they can dare to approach the wall and maybe push it a bit and to see what's on the other side is servile fear. Okay, so my parents' divorce was that crack in that wall. I'm like, maybe this isn't all true. Another thing, I think it was very hard for me. I was very devout in a way that I wanted this religion I believed in to help me through this hard time. And I had this like clear sense that there was nobody on the other side listening to me when I read the Quran or said all the memorized prayers. So combined both of these like spiritual destitute plus that cracking the wall of fear, I started to read the Quran in Turkish for the first time, and I started to read Muhammad's life from the Hadith, which is like his Muhammad's life and saying that was collected during and after his lifetime by his own followers. Excuse me. So what happened is, when I read Muhammad's life, I was like, is this the guy we've been told about? Because what we were told, that he never started wars of aggression. He was the ideal man, right? We all, every Muslim should be just like him, strive to be just like him. I'm like, I can't be just like him. Like, I am a woman. Like, there is no way a woman can be just like Muhammad in his imitation. And when I read about his life written by his own followers, I saw how violent he was. And, you know, there was a lot of wars of aggression. He killed unarmed villages, you know, killed the man, took the children and the women as slaves. I mean, it's awful. And it's written by his own followers. And the treatment of women is just, it was so bad. I couldn't believe that this is the religion of millions of people. But again, that wall of fear could be very strong. When I was studying American history, we were reading about the Civil War, and they're like, why didn't all these slaves rise up and fight against their masters? I'm like, you're thinking with a free man's mind who has never known servile fear and its crippling effect. Like, you can't. Right? Like, how could a system of slavery be sustained when slaves outnumber their masters, what, 500-1? Right? Because that fear is so strong. But as free men, when you grow up here, despite all its, you know, faults, you still grow up in that freedom, and it's hard to understand. So that was my reaction. And slowly, the more I read about Muhammad, I fell away from Islam. I didn't become atheist because I just didn't know. Like, I had nowhere else to go. So I just like, okay, I'm not Muslim anymore. And I found a few other misfit children like me. Like, you know, there wasn't anybody else whose parents were divorced that I knew of. Divorce was that uncommon. But I had a friend whose parents were like secret atheists. And, you know, so like, we kind of formed this little, I don't know, geeky, like misfit group. But what one of the side effects of falling away from Islam was that I lost the only moral compass I had. So starting from age 12, I started drinking. I was like regularly drunk. Thank God I didn't have an, I don't have an like addictive gene. Otherwise, I think I would have been long dead. And we would like get drunk and play chess. Like that was that was our thing. And of course, this kind of got worse as I went to high school and college, and I became more and more militantly atheist. I dismissed Christianity and is Christianity or Judaism or any kind of, because I don't know why I never questioned what Islam taught about Christianity. Because, I mean, when you look at the Christian claim on its face, it's much more ridiculous than what, you know, Islam claims. So I was like, okay, all the religions are the same. They're here to kind of enslave men, you know. It's the opium of the masses, just to control, like, you know, all that stuff. And I kind of became this militant atheist and a hardcore communist. It was, but I was always like, okay, there is one truth. And this truth may be miserable, like, let's face it. If there is no God, tomorrow is very, very bleak. It's like, hey, there's one truth, and the truth is worth being miserable for. So I was never kind of this relativist, like, you do what you makes you happy. It's like, no, I just never went there. And I think that's a somewhat of a new phenomenon anyway. So by the time I was 19, I knew everything. As you guys probably feel sometimes in your time. But one of the things that made university life very hard for me, that was that my parents didn't support me, because, you know, they were divorced and my father was married to his third wife, I think. So I had to support myself, which was like unheard of, which is still unheard of in Turkey. It's like, if your kid goes to college, you pay for everything. Their, you know, dorm, everything. So it's like nobody work, no college student works in Turkey. So I was like, okay, I need a job, and I still need a job flexible enough so I can, you know, go to university and have some kind of financial freedom. So one day I'm waiting at this bus stop, and there's this sign. It says, American woman looking for a Turkish college student who can speak English. My English wasn't this good back then, and but I spoke well enough. And but I looked at this sign, like, with my luck, she already found somebody. So I went about my day, and I came back home. And at night, you know, pajamas, slippers, watching TV, and there's this like voice in my head. It keeps saying, "Go get the number. Go get the number." I'm like, like 10 at night, I'm not gonna get up in the middle of the night. But he won't shut up. He's like, go get the number. So I'm like, fine. So I kind of shuffle to the bus stop, write down the number, come back home. It's like 10:30 by this time, and you don't call anybody after 9 in Turkey. So I call this lady, because this voice would not give up. And the lady said, hey, it's okay, you come, I haven't found anybody, come tomorrow for an interview and we'll see if it works out. So I show up at her house. So she opens the door and she's not blonde. I'm like, are you saying all the Hollywood movies lie? What do you mean you're American and not blonde? Where is your cleavage and miniskirt and, you know? So I was like, you just like this, you know, brunette. And wearing a shirt and jeans. And she opens the door. And so she's living in the middle of this Muslim country. And it's not like even an affluent area of Ankara. I'm in Ankara, by the way, for my studies now. And so there's this verse from the Bible, cross-stitched right across her entrance door, which everybody can see. It says, there's no salvation. It's from Acts 4:12. There's no salvation under heaven except by his name. So I'm like, oh, great, she's a Christian. So I go in, and she hires me. And the very first lesson, I'm like, are you a Christian? Do you still believe in this crazy stuff? Little did I know, she was raised an atheist. She became a Christian when she was in college. And she went to a really good school here. Wellesley, is that? Yeah, that one. She went there, and she had a good job. in New York, but she felt the call to go and preach the gospel in Muslim countries. So they sold everything here, moved over there, and here I show up, and I am so sure I am right. Again, I'm still 19, not much changed. And so for 3 years with this lady and I, we talked about God. We read the Bible from front to back in Turkish and English. She was the first pro-life woman I've ever met. I had never heard this concept of pro-life, because in Islam it's complicated. They say the spirit enters the body at the time of quickening. So there's no like pro-life, consistent pro-life belief. Some sects are a lot more strict than the others. So for 3 years we met 2 weeks, two times a week, and 2.5 hours a day. This lady and I talked. Again, little did I know she was a convert. So what I talk about her in my book. Her name is Therese. She's very anti. She was very anti-Catholic. The God she talked about was very different from Allah. So Allah, in Allah's case, a sin in Islam, a sin is a sin because Allah says so. So there is no, like, you can't say Allah is all good, because that means you're putting a limit on him, right? Whereas in Christianity, obviously, we believe that sin is sin, not because God feels like that way today and he can change his mind tomorrow, but it's ultimately against our own good, right? Or against our own nature. So this God she talked about was all good, consistent, and pure. And as an atheist, one of the things I was, again, so geeky, I was into, like, reading science fiction and all that stuff. And I just realized that, for science to prosper, you expect this consistency from universe, right? Here, and, I don't know, 3 galaxies away as well. And I was like, why would we accept this consistency if there isn't a common author, in a way, right? Like, why would you have that? But you can't function without that, which is one of the reasons science doesn't prosper in Muslim countries, because you can't expect that. And you can't learn anything about Allah from the nature, because, again, like, he's above and beyond our comprehension. Why would you even try to learn about him? So those were the 3 things. So it's not that she convinced me that God existed, but she made me realize that it was possible that God existed, and he would still be bigger than this worldview of mine, right? He would be still compatible with the science and evolution and all this crazy stuff, because he would be just above and beyond. It's like she almost like introduced me as a much bigger God than Allah. But I said, even if that God exists, I don't want to believe him, because how can an old good God, a benevolent God, let so much evil happen in the world, right? The problem of evil, we've all probably struggled at some point in our lives. And again, this my background in Islam, because there isn't a consistent understanding of sin, nor there is an understanding of original sin, right? If there isn't if a sin is a sin because he says so, there can't be an original sin. So, like, they believe the children are, like, sinless till they're 7 or so. So it's like, it's just a, because there's no taint. I mean, we believe that too because of actual sin, but there's no taint of original sin. Like, there's no concupiscence and all that stuff. There's no understanding of that. So I didn't understand that, how sin affects the person and their action. So, but God is patient, thankfully. So this is the end of my sophomore year in college. And I had a professor, a Fulbright scholar, who was teaching us advanced English, because this terrible language has words like ubiquitous. And what I was trying to say, what was the word? I was trying to say, what is that place, Potomac? Like, it's just such a painful language if you didn't grow up in it. So he used to make us watch CNN, but he duct tape at the bottom, you know, when it's so that we wouldn't, like, we wouldn't cheat, because he wanted us to understand the crazy American accent. Anyway, so this guy, wonderful as he was, a Buddhist, and he was very anti-Christian. The first person I met with a peanut allergy, I had never seen anybody with a peanut allergy. He couldn't eat anything, you know, in Turkey. Nothing is ever labeled. So he gave us this chapter from this guy called Dostoevsky. Anybody read Brothers Karamazov? Okay, so it's the chapter, Grand Inquisitor. It stands alone. If you don't want to read it, just go read that chapter. But it's, there are four brothers. The oldest, Ivan, is a communist, and the youngest, Alyosha, is becoming a monk. And this is a parable. Ivan is telling Alyosha so he doesn't become a monk and waste his life. So in this parable or story, or Christ is coming back to earth. It's not the second coming. He's just coming down to check out how things are. And of course, it's the time of the Spanish Inquisition, because Catholics are always the bad guys. Dostoevsky was an Orthodox, didn't like the Catholics, but it's okay, nobody's perfect. So he, so Christ is walking around, and he heals people, he raises this one girl from the dead, and everybody recognizes him for who he is. And he's gathering this crowd around him. As he walks along the cathedral steps, this cardinal, the Grand Inquisitor of the Catholic Church, sees him. And he tells his guards that he to arrest Christ. And they put Christ into a dungeon. And nobody, none of his followers stopped them or tried to protest. So at night, Cardinal Wenz goes down to the dungeon. And the rest of the story is this conversation between Christ. No, actually, Cardinal talks, because Christ never talks, because the public revelation ended with the death of St. John. He has said everything he could possibly say at that point. So Christ is sitting there, and the cardinal says, like, why did you come back? We've been trying to clean up your mess over a millennia. You wanted to give these people heavenly bread, but all they want is the earthly bread we offer. You wanted them to choose you on their own free will, but all they want is security and what we offer. He said, you should have, this chapter revolves around Christ's temptation in the desert. It's beautiful. Said, you should have accepted the Satan's offer of turning the stones into the bread, because this is all these people want. You should have accepted his offer to create an earthly kingdom, because all they want is the peace and the security. They don't want the free will you offer. They don't want the choices you offer. They just want to live happy, comfortable lives. And he says, go back and let us just finish, like, fix what you've messed up. And Christ gets up, he kisses the cardinal and leaves the dungeon. And Alyosha hears this story, and he gets up and he kisses his brother, and he also leaves. Of course, he goes on to his story. So it's in the middle of the night. I'm reading this translation from Russian to English, but it's kind of like older English. So I have like these giant dictionaries. I had so much coffee and tea. It's 3 in the, you know how it goes. I waited till the last night. So, but it's like, for the first time in my life, I saw what sin is and how sinful I was, right? It's like somebody held up a spiritual mirror. So I am a communist, and one of the reasons a lot of people attracted to communism is because they don't understand our sinful nature, right? If there is no sin in me, like if I am not inherently sinful or prone to sin, then that means all the evil in the world is because of some external reason. So if we come up with the just perfect system, then we will have heaven and earth. And that's what I thought, right? This guy was a rape. I don't want to point that way. This guy was a rapist because, you know, he was suppressed by the unattainable social goals or whatever. This one was a murderer because of this reason. This one was a thief because the rich took from the poor or whatever, right? So it's always somebody else's fault. But if we come up with this perfect system, it would happen. But in the middle of the night, I'm sitting here and thinking about what this cardinal said to Christ. I'm realizing, you know what? The evil isn't, the world is evil, not because God is bad or evil or incompetent. It's because he gave us free will. And in our sinfulness, we make the world evil and miserable for others. There is enough food in on this earth to feed everybody, but there is famine because we don't want to share. Or the leaders of a country wants to accumulate power and suppress the, you know, like, it's always somebody's sin. And it's also my sin, you know? Chesterton, they ask, what's the problem? What's the, what is it? What's the problem with the world? What's wrong with the world? And he answered, I am. And that's the night I realized that I am. All the bad choices I made in life, and I made many bad choices. There isn't enough time to talk about how many bad choices I made in life. And I just, like, I had this, like, film of people I've hurt and the rippling effect of my own sin, right? We are not islands. Every decision we make affects somebody. So I'm sitting in there and I just realize, like, everything kind of falling into place. Like, this Christian God, then we would need his sacrifice. Because how can I save myself if I am, like, inherently sinful, right? If I am at the bottom of the well, if somebody doesn't throw me a rope, how can I ever go up? So I understood, and everything fall into place. And I woke up, went to school, went to class, and as it happened, Satan doesn't like people getting too close to Christ. My boyfriend then, we were living together. He graduated at the end of that month, basically moved away. And this lady that I've been teaching Turkish, and basically I was going through college which she gave me as payment. And she came to America for a sabbatical. So everything, like, in my life was falling apart. So I kind of put all this thoughts about Jesus and Christianity on the side. But thankfully, Holy Spirit is a lot more patient with me than I ever was. And he sent me another family, again, Americans, again, missionaries. We don't say the M word in Turkey, but they had little kids. And they asked me to teach their little kids. So one was around 3 or 4, the other one's around 6. I wish I had the patience I had back then with my own little ones. But what happens when you teach the children is that you witness the family life, right? Like, you're around all the craziness, up and down. And for the first time in my life, I saw, like, what Christ did in people's lives. So my struggle was basically all intellectual, again, the geekiness, you know. And the Lord had given me that all the intellectual proofs that I needed to get there. But it had always stayed here, and this is a long way. And as I taught these little ones, I realized that, look, what kind of life do they have? Like, the joy and hope and love in their life was almost tangible. And I was like, I bet they're faking. I mean, they're just, like, nice and good while I'm here. And then as soon as I leave, they're going to be like all the dysfunctional families I've known growing up. But I didn't want to leave their house because that was the only place I felt, like, loved unconditionally. And I felt peace and that joy that only comes from Christ's peace. It was wonderful. I didn't want to leave. A few times they had to kick me out. I understand now, because kids wake up very early and parents need their sleep. So, but I couldn't make up my mind. So I kept thinking about, look, if I become a Christian, then I won't be able to get a job. So it's like a soft persecution in Turkey. There are people who were murdered because they become Christians. But normally it's like you can't get a government job because once you become a Christian, you're basically a traitor to the country. So I'm like, what am I going to tell to my boyfriend who's an atheist? All my friends are atheist communists. We sit around drinking and mocking God. It's going to be a really awkward conversation once I show up telling them, yeah, I actually believe this crazy Jesus stuff and he rose from the dead and all that stuff. So it's like I kept, like, worrying about this worldly stuff. Again, the Lord is patient. So I'm going to school. I haven't slept. I mean, I'm going to class. I haven't slept really well for a week because I keep worrying about this stuff. So it's 8:40 class. That's the earliest class we had. I don't know how it is here. So I'm walking. Nobody's there because nobody wants to get up at that ungodly hour. Now I have, because I wake up at 6. But so as I go, suddenly I had this like seen in front of my eyes. You have probably heard that, you know, a lot of people come to Christ through visions and dreams, because I think like we just need like a spiritual reassurance, like almost like a push, or like this was my like slap in my back of my head, because God is like, what more do you want? Here, one more thing. So it's like this scene was outside. It's like a big meadow, mountains in the back, and there's a little girl sitting on the grass. She's wearing a white dress and kind of sitting in the Indian style, looking down on her lap and playing with these little toys. And you can't even see the toys because they're tiny compared to this meadow. And their two hands come from the sky. And these hands were so big, you can't see like above the wrist. And they're handing this girl this present. But this present is not your regular present. It's just like glowing. And there's something inside that this little girl cannot even comprehend, let alone ever afford or get for herself. But she doesn't even realize that this gift is being given to her. So she's still looking on her in her lap and playing. And finally she sees this gift. And she looks up at the owner and she says, no, thank you. I have these little things to play with. You're an idiot. How could you possibly compare that gift with your like tiny toys? And I realized, I'm like, oh, wait, that's what I'm doing. Christ has been trying to give me this wonderful gift. And I kept like thinking, but of my job, this or that, and you know. And finally I get it. So the following day I went to this lady, the kid's mother. And I tell her, I think this is a good day to become a Christian. So she dropped all the plates she was washing. And we prayed, if you're familiar, the prayer to accept Jesus into your heart. And I was baptized. So I prayed the Jesus prayer in October. And I was baptized in May. Full immersion baptism. Great. We went to eat Chinese. We had only two Chinese restaurants in Ankara. So it was a great treat. And, you know, all the stuff I worried about came true. Like, you know, I broke up with my fiance. I lost all my friends. I couldn't get a government job. All those true. But, hey, you know, it was the light, the joy and the peace the Lord gave me. It was like, hey, you know, if this doesn't happen, I'll go this way. And I decided to get my graduate degree so I can at least teach at a private university. Because, like, they don't care you are, as long as you're not too open about it. So one of the ministries I joined was that me and a few other friends of mine, we ran this teenage Christian camp for teenagers. It was behind the walls of Ephesus. Once a year, we got about 150 teenagers, high schoolers. It was crazy. It was great. And I met somebody there who goes by the name Anthony in my book. And we became very good friends because we had the same degrees, same majors, I think same years. And as we go through doing this ministry, trying to find fun things to do for teenagers, he was attending Notre Dame. He was a missionary kid who grew up in Turkey, basically Turkish. He speaks English and, you know, Turkish. He came to Notre Dame for his college degree. And then he finished it while I get my master's and all that stuff. So we are kind of living this parallel life. And while I was getting my master's degree, I had an agnostic roommate. So I went to Istanbul where Anthony worked. And I said, okay, between Anthony and me, we will get her. Like, you know, we will convert her, as if you can actually convert people. So I was like, yeah. So I take her to the lunch with Anthony, and he's like, okay, Daddy, I'm going to tell you something, but don't be mad. Can you tell me that I can be mad? He says, I became Catholic. No, you didn't. Okay, so you don't understand how anti-Catholic Muslims are, right? Crusades. You watch old Turkish movies, every bad guy is a Catholic. You see a guy wearing the tabard with the cross on, you know he's going to rape a woman in about 5 minutes. Like, it's just so bad. It's like this, because I don't know, again, history. The Ottoman Empire sided with Protestant princes because, hey, if Christians kill each other, we don't have to kill them, right? Like, so they sided with the Protestant princes against the Catholics. So so it's very anti-Catholic, and most of the Protestants around me were very anti-Catholic as well. They're like, you know, the Pope is the Antichrist, the Catholic Church is the whore of Babylon, like all of it. They worship Mary, they worship saints, like every Protestant cliche you could ever think. But one of the things, as I read, because a geek is a geek is a geek, right? So I am still reading all these books. I became a Christian, like I want to know what I read. And there are a few things that really bothered me. So the first one was the lack of a magisterium. Like, I didn't understand that how Christ, he knew, who knew us so well, loved us so well, that he would become man, die for us, raise from the dead, and say, hey, just hang in there, I'll send a book in a few hundred years. Like, I mean, he left and St. Paul and St. Peter were fighting, what, in what, 15 years? I don't know, 10 years? So he knew, like, it didn't make sense that he wouldn't leave anything behind, right? So that was one of the things. And of course, the disunity, even among the, like, really solid missionaries around me, was very appalling. So, you know, I don't know if you met any missionaries. Most of them are really good Christians. They're committed, obviously, if you're leaving your home here, going to a different country. But they were very, even, like, they were divided on, like, abortion. I'm like, that's kind of a matter of life and death. Like, you shouldn't be so divided on it. Or one of the things, they weren't sure about the Trinity because the word Trinity didn't appear in the Bible, right? So, like, there were really deep divisions, and that didn't make sense if Christ desired our unity so much that he wouldn't leave a way to sustain it. And another one was sola scriptura, Bible alone. Like, again, it goes with the magisterium. How can I trust my own judgment? Clearly, I have been shown that I have been, like, I cannot be trusted with, you know, with interpreting this, like, such a life-changing. Or, like, how, why would I trust Father Brian necessarily, or his judgment? Or, you know, and I have, again, all the Christians I'm surrounded with are solid Christians, you know. They live good, moral, faithful lives. But I'm like, why would I choose you over this guy? Right? So it just didn't make sense that there are so many interpretations over one book, and it just didn't seem consistent with what the Lord has said within the scriptures. And the third one was, hang on, this is kind of silly, and I know there's a lot of, so I was very, you know, science and evolution and all that stuff, and I was surrounded by creationists who kind of try to make the scriptures fit into science. And I was like, I think God can create a universe that could accommodate science, right? So I felt like the way they treated the Bible was the way Muslims treated the Quran, in a way, right? Like a science textbook, which, like, Bible never claims to be. So that was very hard for me. Again, but if you don't have a magisterium, like, what do you do with the weird passages? Like, do you take it literal? Who decides which, what is literal, what is figurative, or whatever? That was okay. There were four of them, but I can't remember. It'll come to me anyway. So, but I'm thinking, look, I don't know enough. I need to read more and more about this Christianity stuff. As much as I love it, I just need to read more about theology to learn it. So when Anthony is telling me these, of course, none of this is, I didn't know anything about the Catholic Church. Nothing. Like, everything is all prejudice. Never read Catholic theology. So I'm so mad at Anthony. We didn't convert my roommate. She's like, oh, look, Christians are killing each other again. It's like, I should have brought popcorn. So we went back to Ankara. So the university I was attending has the best library. So I march over there. I'm going to find this a book about Catholic theology, and I'm going to prove them all wrong. So I am about, what, 24 now, so I definitely know everything. I mean, I'm not 19 anymore, right? So I go in there, and there's one book on Catholic theology written by this guy called Joseph Cardinal Ratzinger, whoever he was. I kid you not, I had no idea he was the Pope. Like, I am that ignorant of the Catholic Church, and he was the Pope. And so I pick up this book. It's the Introduction to Catholic Theology, published by Ignatius Press, you know. So I pick it up, I open it. My people, it's not an introduction. I could not pass the introduction, this introduction. So I'm like, oop, I closed it and just like put it back with this like respect. I'm like, so I go back, I'll find something easier on the internet, right? It's like nobody's reading Ratzinger. So I went back and Anthony sent me this book by this guy called Mark Shea. He's kind of gone off the rails the last few years, but you know, he converted from evangelical Christianity and he wrote this like tiny little book called By What Authority. So he takes all the claims of the Catholic Church that are just so offensive to evangelical ears and looks at their scriptural basis, right? And I'm just reading this tiny book, so much easier than Ratzinger. And I'm like, I found all the answers to the questions that's been like bugging me and nagging me. Again, it's like in my book, I kind of go into a little more depth into it. And that was the beginning of the end for me in the evangelical church. And that was almost like harder to leave than atheism because I had found a true community among the Protestants, and which something we should, as Catholics, we should imitate because they had given me a home. Like we had the small groups, we met every week. Like they had become my family because I had no other family. And next thing I know, there are two Catholic churches in Ankara. One is on French embassy and the other one is on the Vatican embassy. And so the French, the one on the French embassy, I keep calling them because I want to see the priest. You can't just walk in or make an appointment, right? It's, they think you're a government agent trying to trick them. So I keep calling them. The priest doesn't want to talk to me. So I called them, I think, I don't know, 10 times. I don't remember. So finally, this guy picks up the phone, awful Turkish. Like, I couldn't understand anything he said. He's like, why are you bugging my people? I said, I really want to become a Catholic. I'm so confused. What do I do? He's like, I will give you 15 minutes. So I travel an hour and a half to go to like from one end of the city to other, snowing. And I knock on this door. Like, they're like iron gates that he opens and he lets me in. So it's like he serves me fennel tea. He's like this French Jesuit. Good one. 75 years old or so. He lived in like Chad for 30 years. Just moved to Turkey like 2 months ago. Speaks who knows how many languages. But between the two of us, there were three languages. Turkish, French, and English. Like, my French was like intermediate. His English, intermediate. Turkish was awful. Like, between the three languages, he's like, okay. Like, he decided that I wasn't crazy or a government agent. So, like, we, you know, we don't have an RCIA because it's not, like, a consistent flow. So there were a few other people who were you wanted to become Catholic. We worked through the Gospel of Matthew. And then right before I got confirmed in Turkey, I had to move to England for my PhD because I always wanted to go back and, you know, be one of the Christians in there. And it, one of the ways to do it, to go get a degree in the West, and then it's just so much easier to find a job. So I moved to England, went through RCIA again, like two and a half years of RCIA. It was torturous. And then I got confirmed in the St. Cuthbert's Church in Durham, England. And while I was studying there, the story is about to end. Hang in there. So that was in 2008, I think. Yes, 2008. And I'm studying there, so I wasn't called to the religious life. That was, I just never felt the call. Maybe I converted a little too late, or maybe I live in a Muslim country. But there was no Catholic to marry. I'm just telling you this. Normally, I end the talk before this. I am telling you this. Find someone to marry while you're in college. It's just going to get really bad after this. I'm telling you, just don't do the friend zone thing. Ask somebody out, and if she says no, it's not the end of the world. It's fine. Just move on. Just find somebody and just get married, people. It's just so bad. So I'm in grad school. There are like 27 men and 3 women. None of them were Catholic even. Like, I'm in political science. So what do you do? What do you do? So a friend of mine who was a Protestant found her husband on eHarmony. So I'm not going to go there. But I was ridiculously poor. Still poor. It just continues. I had money enough to get like 3 months membership for Catholic Match. and said, Lord, I have this much money. I can't afford more. If you want this, you'll find somebody for me in 3 months. So I got on it. And my husband, who was in the Air Force in Texas, he wasn't even stationed in England or anything. And I didn't even put America because I didn't want to come this far from Turkey. He was the first guy I met, and which is not normal. If you go on like online dating, it takes a while. So we met and we got married in 2009, and I moved here, finished my PhD. I wrote my dissertation here. I was studying American foreign policy, so it wasn't a big deal. And over 10 years later, we have 4 kids, and I'm staying at home to take care of them. And PhD is completely useless when you deal with little ones, just so you know. But the Lord has been wonderfully good to me, more than anything I deserve. But he still loves us so much that he gives above and beyond. So thank you for listening. Any questions? Do we have time for questions?
Any questions?
I think I was a little too frazzled to have a, I don't know. I was crying, I remember, and I tried to explain him in 15 minutes what I've been through. And I think he realized a government agent would be a little more like composed and cool or whatever. Like, I think he just wanted, because they're not, you're not about, another word I really can't pronounce, proselytize, right? Proselytize, right? Okay. So you're not allowed to do that in Turkey, and you will get kicked out. So they just need to be very careful who they talk to. So he was being overly cautious. And obviously, we Catholics have dropped the missionary ball long ago. So that was the conversation. I think he just realized that I wasn't trying to trap him or trick him or anything. Yeah.
I have a question. You mentioned the magisterium. So the magisterium, for those who might not know, that's the Darren explained that. But it's the teaching authority of the church, like the fact that the church can say that this this is a teaching that you must follow, you must believe. And then magisterium is exercised in ordinary and extraordinary ways. For instance, Our Lady of Lourdes, yesterday we celebrate, she affirmed the dogma of the Immaculate Conception, which is an extraordinary teaching of the magisterium of the church. So the magisterium drew you to the faith. Was there any other aspects that drew you to as well that you were intrigued by?
I can't remember number 4. I don't know why. There were like 4 aspects, but the magisterium. Oh, only faith, sola fideism. Yes, duh. That was a big one because, again, you know, I come to this realization of free will and what the Protestant taught, that it's just like once you pray the prayer, accepted Jesus into your heart, is as if your free will disappeared, right? Once saved, always saved. So I have a lot of Presbyterians who believe in predestination, and like once saved, always saved. And then I had other ones who said, you can't lose your salvation. That means you were never saved. Like if you fall away from Christ, right? Because there can be no works. So if your works are not reflecting your life as a Christian, that means you were never saved. And I'm like, that doesn't make sense. Also, how is saying the prayer not a work, right? It's like tiny work counts, but no other counts. And I didn't see any biblical support for faith alone. You know, anytime anybody said faith alone was, you're not saved by faith alone, like not saved by faith alone, you know, in Book of James, which Luther admittedly have wanted to get rid of, but couldn't. But yeah, that one, the 4, I couldn't remember. But yeah, and there are a lot of common objections that like the saints and Mary were big obstacles. Not for me, because saints made sense, because I didn't understand that how death would suddenly separate us. Like clearly death has no power over Jesus. Why would we die, and if Lord willing make it to heaven, why couldn't we help people? Like I asked my friends to pray for them. If anything, they are closer to the source. So that like never bothered me, but there were a lot of other Protestant friends around me. They were really bothered with that, saints and Mary. Again, I don't, even though I didn't have a good relationship with my mother, I understood how Jesus would, in his perfection, would want us to revere his mother because he did. Like, if he did, how much more should we revere his mother? You know, he went back with Saint Joseph and Our Lady after he was caught. He was caught in the temple. Like, if he showed that much reverence and deference, how much more should we show? So those weren't the things that bothered me, but those for an evolution. I know it's still like a touchy topic in some Catholic circles, but I think there's so much more freedom in Catholic theology because of the magisterium and because of the depth of philosophy. Like, the more I learn about the Catholic Church, I feel like as a Protestant, I was like, I found the ocean and I dipped my feet in. But as a Catholic, I can go into the depths, and the more I go in, there's like more stuff to see and find, and that's the beauty of it. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, she mostly talked about the personhood. Like, so she didn't, you know, she didn't go to the Bible or like, she talked about how, if a potential person was still a person, because that's what the pro-life decision comes down to, you know, like if this is a person, even if it's like this big, it doesn't matter. Killing that person is murder. I mean, I think like in America, this pro-life speech has just moved, like they accept that it's a person, but it's kind of my choice because it's in my body, so it's a parasite. But for me at that point, I didn't accept the personhood of it, and I hadn't really thought much about it. You know, it's like most people, I don't think, put a lot of thought in it because it's just uncool to be pro-life. But I had never met a pro-life. I just knew of these crazy Christians who were like fundamentalists who believed in this stuff. You know, I was a feminist, communist, atheist. Like, obviously I thought, hey, if you don't want the baby, you can get rid of it. It's just tissues. Also, of course, I didn't believe in soul. So what did it matter if somebody lived 100 years or 3 weeks, right? We were all like doomed to die. So if some people had to die earlier for the convenience of others, who cared? Like, as Stalin said, if you want to make an omelet, you're going to have to break a few eggs. Does it make sense? Like, it's kind of, if a person isn't inherently valuable because of who he is, because a person is created in the image of God, then he or she is expendable. And this is true in Islam, the same. Like, they don't believe that Muslims are created in the image of Allah. That's like blasphemy. So it's like, it kind of lowers a person to more like utilitarian. Like, are you useful? Are you needed? Are you wanted? Then you can be killed. Does that make sense? So that was my view. And she made me understand that, like, no, this is a person inherently. Not that I agreed, but I kind of understood where she was coming from.
Because you have such a unique position, having had kind of different beliefs, when we're talking to people of, like, a Muslim or an atheist or a Protestant, are there certain things you think in those certain positions would have planted seeds? Obviously, it's the Holy Spirit who
Fine.
Works in people's hearts, and it's important to have relationships. That's how you're able to, you know, form trust. But are there seeds, like certain things in those different positions, had people maybe talked to you about or asked certain questions that would have maybe
Fine.
Had you start thinking about?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, again, we can't convert anybody. So pray and fast if there's somebody, you know, in your life that who needs grace. But I think a Christian's life, a faithful life, is an amazing witness, because now we stand so apart from the world. It's not like before everybody lived in like somewhat similar morality. It's just so different. So a faithful Catholic life is a wonderful witness. And of course, know your faith. Again, it's not like before that everybody kind of knew enough. But it's like you just need to be always prepared to answer the questions. And if you don't know, like one of the things with that missionary lady, She's like, oh, I don't know about that. Let me read about it, get back to you. Like, that was like, oh, she feels so confident enough what she believes that she's okay to read further. But I think what was especially for Muslims, and I think this is true for atheists too, just to bring them to a place of question. You know, the way like St. Thomas that ask, you know, ask and answer, but just, you know, ask them. It's like, you say the, you know, Muslims believe the Bible is changed. Where is it changed? Can you show me? When was it changed? Like, we have all these manuscripts. Can you show me how they differ? Or bring them to a place that so they can question their own beliefs rather than like a confrontation. Because we want to, we are a lot more open around people we feel safe with. So if a friend asks me a question, they're questioning my beliefs, then I'm a lot more inclined to take that question seriously than somebody who's just trying to win an argument or whatever, right? So there's like a, and I think those are more general, general rules. And I think for atheists, most of them dismiss the philosophical proofs for God. Like, I think you just need to show again that God is just, it's not a scientific question. God's existence is a metaphysical question, not a scientific question. So like, kind of bring them into a place of understanding where science stands. Like, it's one of the things I try to say, you know, I write fiction. It's one day my characters become sentient, right? Self-aware. They have no way of understanding me in their little two-dimensional world unless I tell them so. And whatever science they can conjure up with in on paper would be well beyond, like, my, would be too, like, too limited to understand me, who I am as the author. Does it make sense? So, like, kind of bring them to a place to understand these are different subjects. But I think the biggest thing is prayer, fasting, know your faith, and live a faithful life. And you would be surprised, like, how many people realize that, hey, this weirdo seems to be doing some things wrong. Like, we need to be okay to be the weird people. I mean, you know, I take all my kids to Sam's Club here. They're, when I show up by myself, they're like, where are they? I'm like, I'm free today. I can show up all myself. Like, people see it. Your faithful life, your devotion. You know, I was talking about, it's one of the books that my husband and I, we've been going to Latin Mass for a little over a year. And they're like, why do you travel an hour, 20 minutes to go to Latin Mass? I'm like, look, I am not here for the squishy stuff. Right? I can buy really good music on iTunes and just listen to it. I don't have to get up for, you know. But I go there and I feel like, hey, I have stepped out of time. I'm here for the beauty. I am here for the reverence. So this goes for the church and for our individual lives, right? Like, I have no problem bringing a friend, atheist friend, hey, come look at the vestments. Like, you don't believe in God, but the vestments are nice. Come listen to the Gregorian chant, you know, the organ play, right? So it's like, again, that faithful, reverent, distinct life that a Catholic can offer just can come a long way. So, yeah. Sorry, long answer. I can't stop talking. Much better than before. Again, I said it was a very broken. And after I became Christian, this is still when I'm Protestant, I couldn't find in me to forgive them. And my mentor, the guy who baptized me, he said, you say a prayer for them every night. And I would sit down and try to say a prayer every night. And I couldn't even like wish them a good night's sleep. Like that, there was so much hatred in my heart. And I just realized like the extent of it and slowly kind of, like, I said, okay, you know, let them not get a fatal disease today or something, you know. So it's just slowly I started to pray for them. And, like, you just don't even realize how, like, deep that hatred goes. Because, you know, most of my life I tried to get rid of their influence. So when I finished college, I invited them to my graduation ceremony. And I told them I became Christian. And just because of the grace of God that I am willing to talk to them. So they like the changes in my life. They really like my husband. And they love my children. So they come and visit us in here all the time. And it's like they like the changes in my life. and what Christ made me into, but they still don't really want to talk about. Does it make sense? So they are happy with the fruits, but you know, I still pray for them, and you guys keep them in your prayers too. But so we've come a long way, relationship wise.
Thank you very much again.
Thank
now,
you.
Do you have books with
them? I do have books, but I forgot to bring change, and I also forgot to bring my credit card machine. So, but I do have the books if you have the exact change, but if not, you can buy them online.
Also, if they're interested in books, we can write their names down and contact you.
Right, yes, so. That's also definitely. So, but this is, hang on, let me show you. So this is my conversion story, published by Ignatius Press. Just like the book I couldn't read. But like much easier than Ratzinger's book, so don't be scared. And this is, again, I don't know, do you say Latin Mass? I don't know. But if you've never been to the Latin Mass, it's really scary. So my husband and I, we came up with this little booklet. So we explain what's going on the left, and we tell you where to kneel and when to stand so you don't stick out. But anyway, so that's one of the things. And I have two fiction books I had ordered. I am so unorganized. I don't know how I keep the kids alive, but they're also they're on sale. If you go to my Amazon page, you can, you know, get them all. But I also live around here, so if you can email me daddyalittle@gmail.com, we can meet and I can bring you signed copies. My morbid joke, father, is if I sign you a book and if I get killed by Muslim, this will be a third class relic.